People will talk. Down, down, down. Would the fall never come to an end? I wonder if I shall fall right through the earth. How funny it'll seem to come out among the people that walk with their heads downwards. That was Alice in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll, published in 1865. Welcome to the People Will Talk podcast. Joining me in studio is Maria. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
I'm very happy to hear that as well. So, you know why I was quoting Alice in Wonderland in the introduction, or the pre-intro. Because we recently went to an exhibition of Alice in Wonderland in a wonderful exhibition space here in Madrid by Plaza Castilla, if you're familiar with the geography of the city. What's the name of this special venue?
It's Fundación Canal. They have several places, several venues that we've been to. But this one is kind of like the main one that they have.
So we have been there a few times. The most recent one was of photographs showing Madrid from hot air balloons and all that kind of stuff. And we managed to work that into our tour. literally like 2 seconds of explaining something, but still all gold for our tour people. And you know, we've been there before, and as a venue it's nice, it's pleasant. You go there, there's photographs on the walls, and it's a normal exhibition center. But this time they've really pushed the boat out. They've gone all out and they've decked the place out in whimsy and wonder and Alice things. Or you don't agree, I don't think.
No, I fully agree. I thought there was a pun there when you were saying decking, because like it's like a deck of cards.
No, actually, the pun was very much unintended.
Well, it worked out really well. Because obviously the cards are a very big part of Alice's
story. Are they now? Yeah.
Yes. So yeah.
So there's a special room with a hall of mirrors, for example, which is actually really important to the story, which we can get into in more detail later. But there's a room with a hall of mirrors where you can change shape and everything. And there's a very interesting modern angle to that, because now when you go to these things, you have to navigate all the people taking selfies with the mirrors and things like that. So, which did happen to us. Mm-hmm. And then there's a huge big room where you have the summaries of each chapter and one of Dali's paintings accompanying it as well, because illustrations are really important for the story, in a way that you know illustrations are very important. In fact, there's a quote from Alice. She says in the story, "What are stories? What are books without pictures?" And this is definitely a very illustrative story. And also there's a room with pictures by Dali, and also a few screens where you can see black and white versions of this movie. And also a Disney movie that was inspired by the paintings of Dali, who in turn was inspired by the time-bending darkness and surrealness of the Alice in Wonderland story as well. There's quite a lot of stuff in there, really. So I quite liked it, and I imagine you did too.
I did. There was a lot to it.
So this story, Alice in Wonderland, I think we're all familiar with it. It's something that's in the popular culture, even if you haven't directly read it. It's been that influential. There's a song by Jefferson Airplane called White Rabbit, and believe it or not, it's about drugs. And also the character of Alice has been used to sell things like Guinness and other nefarious products as well. But I think for me, what I, you know, this prompted me to look more into the story of Alice in Wonderland and what the deeper meaning of it was. So, first of all, with the deeper meaning, linguistically, apart, you know, Shakespeare was famous for creating lots of idioms, mum's the word, for example, and really shaping the English language in a way that most books simply don't do. 1984 has done it with the special room. Ironically, I can't remember what it's called. Room 101, of course. and Big Brother being another concept as well. Let's test your knowledge of words coined by the book. Smiling like a Cheshire cat. Well, this is an easy one.
Yes, I think that definitely comes from the book.
Well, no, they all do.
I know.
But of course, being really happy, you know.
Did you say weirdest thing?
Mad as a Hatter.
Mm-hmm.
Jabberwocky.
I didn't know that one.
That means any kind of nonsense. Mm-hmm. And Wonderland, like Winter Wonderland. Christmas is coming up. That's a word we'll hear in a Shakin' Stevens song or somebody's.
Like Wonderwall.
Not exactly Wonderwall. No, that would be wrong. There's a few things I can mention here. But one thing I think is quite interesting is that the story reflects the ideal of the Victorian child and the Victorian woman. So, did you know that?
It's funny because I read that, you know, some people think that because Carroll was a mathematician, that he was using the story to kind of like criticize the new methods of doing maths, because a whole lot of things have been added to the discipline that were in the traditional way, and he thought like, that was just ridiculous, and he was a traditionalist, and I don't know. I mean, I think it's probably an interpretation that is not as popular as the one that you've mentioned.
I haven't mentioned it yet, but I will.
Well, you've mentioned it, but you haven't explained it. So
that's a good clarification, yes.
Go ahead and explain.
Well, no, you did bring up science, and I think what is interesting is we've mentioned Pio Baroja before in the podcast. He's a very famous book called The Tree of Science, and there's a statue of him outside of the Retiro Park here in Madrid, and he also features in our tour. A very important figure, but he wrote his book, The Tree of Science, celebrating this age of discovery, because when we think of the 19th century and when we think of the Victorians, we might think of covering the table legs because they might be salacious or very stiff, you know, moral people, which they probably were, but also it was a time of great scientific advancement across many different disciplines, because we only have to see how it went in the 20th century, how things quickly changed from the 1890s to the 1900s to the 1910s. So his book definitely celebrates that. And bizarrely, even though we're talking about him, this links to Alice in Wonderland, because some people say, and of course it's very subjective, and people have loads of interpretations, and they'll write a thesis about it and whatever, and they'll extract something from it. But in its own way, it's an examination of how wonderful science is. And maybe not science per se, but the act of discovery. Because what she's doing is she's discovering new things. And I guess you could say it's related to time. That's certainly something that appealed to people like Dali. And in that sense, it's really focused on the wonder and curiosity. It's a very famous quote, which will be the title of this podcast, Curiouser and Curiouser. And it celebrates, I think, that impulse which underpins all of science before the peer research, before the laboratory, before the test tubes. It's that impulse of wanting to learn. And that's one idea that people say can be found in the book, just to take up your point about the science.
Well, I think that makes more sense, to be honest. You know, because somebody who's focused on, yes, he seemed to have been a bit of a traditionalist, but somebody who is so creative and imaginative, you would have thought would be interested, as you're saying, in, you know, new ways of discovering things. So I think it makes more sense.
You say a traditionalist, and that is interesting, because that does go back to my original point about the ideal of the Victorian child / woman, because in a way his book is upholding those virtues, or what was expected of the Victorian child / woman as they grew to maturity, but in a way it's also subverting it by lamenting it, because the child figure is someone who loves fun and investigating, but the character's growth in the book, and there's no spoilers here, she becomes more serious and sober and cold and rejects what her childish self would do, which is what was expected of the Victorian woman. And as a child passed from that to adulthood, they were expected to put away the childish things. So in a sense, it's reflecting that while lamenting it as well. So in a sense, he is conventional, he's a traditionalist, but also maybe suggesting that it's not the proper way.
Well, that is interesting, but also the fact that, and again, no spoilers, the fact that it's all a dream at the end. You know, in it's a bit of a joke in modern days about like B movies of like when something,
Dallas,
when something is like not very plausible at all.
Sorry, you laughed there because in Spain, Dallas wasn't a thing. You thought you could like just brush over, but no, we're not going to brush over that. Dallas was a very big TV show in the '80s.
Yes, well, we had we were more like Falcon Crest, really.
Okay,
but well.
Let me just finish that point. JR was a massive character in this, and he got shot.
JR.
Yeah, who shot JR? That was the whole thing. And then the season where he was shot turned out to be all a dream, and he was actually alive because I think ratings were falling when he wasn't in the
right.
show. So they brought him back.
Okay, so see, that's a good example. So, like, B movies and Dallas. Where this happened. So, yeah, it's a way of solving out something that is. Apparently not plausible. It's like, oh, it was all a dream. But at the same time, the whole thing of the dream is relevant for surrealism, and that's everything that Dali picks on. So,
but doesn't she wake up, though, at the end of the story? So she wakes up in reality, which shows a triumph and desirability of that reality. I got you there.
No, you didn't, because, well, the reality is what you're talking about the Victorian ideals, but then, you know, it's whether, it all comes down to whether we think dreams are a representation of something like to wish for, I'm not talking Freud here, yeah. Or a way of saying that it was stupid, you know, it was all a dream, it's just foolish.
But wouldn't that be supporting that it was everything that happened in the dream was foolish? So now their waking state is the unfoolish.
That's the point I'm making.
That's supporting my point as well.
Well, we agree. What a surprise.
Okay, we had a roundabout way to do it, but okay. another thing they mentioned, I've read, and I you know, they mentioned that she goes through her identity crisis and her big change. The mirrors represent that because she changes shape and everything as well. And that's another way of reflecting and representing this change of childhood to adulthood as well. For example, so now we mentioned we touched briefly on the illustrations also, so let's go back to how the story was created. So the writer of the story was on a boat trip with his neighbor and his children, and they wanted a story to entertain them. This is more or less the Cliff Notes version, and very meticulously the writer created the book and did all the illustrations, and at the end of the book was a great picture. This is the homemade version, basically, before the book got published. There was a picture of the daughter Alice, who is the foundation or the prototype for the character in the book. And ever since then, the illustration has been really important because the writer realized his illustrations didn't really cut mustard. He found somebody else to do it, and this other guy's illustrations of the Mad Hatter and these other characters have become iconic and have really shaped our understanding of this world in the same way, because we went to another exhibition of Dante's Inferno, and we saw early as well illustrations of his book, which really changed our perception of what hell looks like and created almost forever, really, our visual representation and understanding of these other realms. Which is also interesting because they're selling there for €30 a book of this original guy's illustrations, whose name we'll have to put in the description. Thank you very much. And also Dali's illustrations of Alice in Wonderland as well, because he did do illustrations to represent different parts of the book as well. So I think we could say this was the first child story, or revolutionized child literature. So if you enjoyed Harry Potter as a child, or even not so a child, it's a huge industry now, but it kind of started with this book, and it makes sense that illustrations are a big part of that as well, and it was also a big part of the exhibition. So I don't know if you have anything more to say about that. I guess you do.
About illustrations?
Yes, yeah.
Are we going to talk about DALL-E yet or not yet?
Let's do it. Let's DALL-E it up.
Well, okay. So I think, obviously, as you said, even if you haven't read the book, you see the illustrations, the original ones, and you immediately recognize them. And for example, the one where she's really big, or the one where, you know, she's with a deck of cards. That's all very recognizable. But then DALL-Es are actually like a completely different interpretation of it. And it was done for a special edition in the 60s. And it was very different, picking on this surreal aspect that we've talked about of dreams and what was so popular for the whole surreal movement, but particularly for DALL-E. And of course, one of the main themes is, as you mentioned before, time. And he'd already perfected, you know, his melting clocks, which I'm sure most people are familiar with. But the way, you know, the rabbit and his clock and that device that was used in the story to talk about time being sped up or time being detained really lent itself to be portrayed by these melting clocks. So it's funny because it's not something you would immediately, and in fact, there are rare illustrations, and some of them sold for absolute millions in auction. So it's not something that everybody is aware of, but when you think of it, it does make sense, and that's something that the exhibition highlights.
It's one of the first things you see. It's DALL-E's images turned into a Disney movie. Did you know he was Disney's artist in residence in the 60s?
Well, I didn't know that. The movie's called Destiny. And it's kind of like a set of shapes that develop into different things and tell a story. And it's got powerful music. So it's interesting. And even you, that you're not a big fan of DALL-E, you still appreciated the animated designs that turn into different themes, and it was very creative. So yes, this is a collaboration that was also done between, and it's not something you would normally expect, because you tend to think of DALL-E, you know, as something for adults, and the designs or the drawings, the art is very like complex, and sometimes very crude, or you know, it's not always like what you would class as pretty. But then obviously Disney is famous for, you know, nice faces, and everything is very cute and fluffy and all this. So it's not a partnership you would expect, but it's actually, I think, quite interesting that, you know, they decided to do this thing together.
Well, in another sense, however, that it makes sense that DALL-E was partnering with Disney, because they both were commercial. They both knew how to sell themselves. And DALL-E, the brand, was very lucrative in the same way Disney was as well. You're kind of rolling your eyes there.
You're just being contrarian. Now you're going to tell me about how DALL-E designed the Chupa Chups logo and all this, and that's why it was so commercial. You didn't know that.
I didn't know that. Of course I did, yeah.
So,
When he wasn't designing lobster telephones. Oh, how daring. He's amazing. Sorry, it's the sacred cow of Spain. You cannot criticize DALL-E.
So, not a football podcast. This is not a DALL-E podcast.
It never will be.
We're talking about Alice, for sure.
Oh yeah, Alice. Who the F is Alice?
Exactly. Go on then.
I don't know. I've just kind of got lost in bashing DALL-E. No, but I mean, to be fair, yeah, you're right. I'm not a big fan of his. But apart from that, there are other images there. There was the four pyramids, two big ones and two small ones in the shadow of the big pyramid. Not really a great deep analysis of that, but I liked it. That's all I can say.
Lots of pyramids. Way.
I think according to the description, also something about time and all that crack, you know.
Yeah.
But it's like, I think, you know, you mentioned the pictures being kind of crude and maybe not fitting with the style, but I think it's like listening to the Beatles or watching Monty Python, because it's from the 60s, right? So their idea of time and those things were subversive. So even though we can't possibly fully appreciate the effect of his art in relation to that theme nowadays, in the same way that the Beatles are nice to listen to and Monty Python can be funny, their impact at that time has been lost over the years. And so time as this radical concept that can be changed, when this book was written, when Dali was painting, much more than it is now, was probably a very radical and earth-bending and shaking idea, that it wasn't this linear thing, or it was this thing that could be misshapen somehow. That's my analysis anyway.
Well, I think it's, in a way, it's the precursor of all these like sci-fi movies and books about, you know, the future, and all this idea of like how alternative realities would be. And then if you think about it, I mean, this would be not for a different podcast, but now that we are in the whole thing of the metaverse and that's the future, you look at his paintings and you sort of think there are elements there of, you know, alternative realities or reimagine things that now might feature in computer graphics and so on. But in this case, they were, you know, imagined by people rather than algorithms, for example.
Well, you do mention it is the zeitgeist, the cultural, the multiverse. What is a Marvel movie without the multiverse? You know, because that's all they bang on about, really. So it probably has its roots in this Alice thing. And speaking of multiverses, we have the multiverse of copyright, because there's the book that is legally copyrighted, and this book, which has been shamelessly, apparently a few years ago, copied in China, where they, you heard that story as well, where they ripped off the story and didn't give any credit. I guess why would you, if you're stealing the idea, and just published it across China. Yeah, fair enough, you say. Fair enough. Yeah.
No, I'm being sarcastic. Like,
so, well, we have spoken about it a lot, but there's a couple of other things that we should talk about as well. So I think you wanted to talk about mathematics.
Well, I think it's just an interesting aspect of it, because not everybody knows that he was a mathematician. And it's quite, in a way, it's quite, I'm going to be controversial here and say that, you know, I don't know how many mathematicians are also storytellers.
It's a joke. How many mathematicians does it take to change a light bulb or something?
No, but, you know, of course, there's a lot of science people that are very creative as well. But I think this is an interesting element, because there are a lot of riddles within the story that are proper sort of like, you know, mathematical riddles, as if she was going around doing Sudoku and stuff like that in the modern days. So I find that quite an interesting, it's a characteristic of the book to bring worlds together that you wouldn't expect to go together, such as, you know, these children's stories and maths, you know, surreal paintings, and children's stories again. So, I think that's what I find most interesting, how these things merge in an unexpected way. And of course, the content of the story is fitting of this whole kind of strange encounter between different worlds.
It's a prototype video game, is what it is. You talk about the riddles. There's a character navigating a strange lands, solving riddles, and there's a boss character, because you have the evil queen, right?
Yes, you are the Queen of Hearts.
The Queen of Hearts, yeah. Bacon Tarts. That's a Patrick Kavanagh quote, by the way. So you have the elements of, you mentioned earlier, the multiverse or modern things of sci-fi, but here we have the mechanics of video games as well, which I think could be another podcast as well, because it's just a fleeting thought, not very well developed.
Well, I'm sure it's already developed, but you're not going to tell us until another episode.
Curiouser and curiouser. So that was our account of Alice in Wonderland and the wonderful exhibition in Madrid. Stay tuned for future episodes where we'll be interviewing people, or just talking to ourselves or each other about wonderful
people
things.
People will talk.
People will talk. Culture in and outside Madrid. This is me saying goodbye.
Me saying bye.
Good luck. Bye.